All right, so in Daniel chapter 1, Daniel, along with his buddies, those who are of the tribe of Judah, young men showing wisdom and promise, were taken in the second wave of captives as exiles into Babylon. And Nebuchadnezzar has them put in school to train them in the arts and the language and the ways of the Chaldeans. So the young guys make a stand, as although they are slaves, they're still refusing certain foods and wine in order to follow the commands of God through the law. after that period ends, at the end of chapter 1, Daniel is found to be with wisdom and understanding, and Nebuchadnezzar definitely notices. So in chapter 2, the king has a dream, and it troubles him because he very much wants to know what the dream means. So he brings in his soothsayers and Chaldeans and sorcerers to interpret the dream, and they cannot. they get caught trying to buy time. So he gets pretty upset, and he gets so upset that he orders the execution of all the wise men in the land, including Daniel and his buddies, who were not present at the meeting. But you see God's wisdom in that, because now, you know, one of the things that really jumped out to me going through it this time was when the men couldn't do it, and Nebuchadnezzar gets upset that they couldn't do it, the men just come out and flat out say, "What you're asking, mankind cannot do." And by the way, what you're asking, because mankind cannot do, no king would ever ask mankind to do what you're asking us to do. So now that it has been firmly established in the eyes of the king that man cannot do what needs to be done, it's pretty convenient that Daniel and the gang weren't there, because when Daniel arrives on the scene, Daniel can say again, it was not man that did it, it was God. So that's where we're at. just a little bit of a recap from what we covered last week. If you look in verse 25 of Daniel chapter 2, it says Arioch, that would be the king's executioner, hurriedly brought Daniel into the king's presence and spoke to him as follows, "I have found a man among the sons of the exile from Judah who can make the interpretation known to the king." So I just kind of wondered if maybe he was taking credit here a little bit, because this is the same executioner that was given orders by Nebuchadnezzar to go out and to kill Daniel. And when he showed up at Daniel's door, Daniel said, "Can I have more time?" And the executioner said, "Okay." You think the executioner went back? He's like, "Hey, I did everything you told me, king, except for there was one guy who was like really nice, so I decided not to kill him, but I'll go back and get him later." You know? No. He just stalled, you know? And if Daniel hadn't come up with something in a timely manner, Arioch would have gone through with what he was told to do. But because he did come up with something, now he's rushing back to the king. "I have found," you know. So it's interesting. I don't want to read into it too much. Given the nature of the circumstances leading up to this, I don't know how else he says it to the king. But it does look like maybe he's kind of trying to take a little bit of credit here. So Daniel then, you know, what I find interesting is if you look around verse 18 in chapter 2, God has given Daniel the dream and its interpretation, and it's not until verse 31, until he tells the king. And mostly that gap there between verse 18 and when he begins to tell the king is Daniel preparing the king for the vision, right? Letting him know that, you know, this is, you know, the hand of God and not the hand of man. This is the reason for the dream. A lot of the things that Daniel even says before he's in the presence of the king in verse 20 through 23 really let us know that the dream's purpose was to communicate that God is above any other so-called God, that God is the author of history, and that he is sovereign above all others. So that will be the purpose of the dream. And then kind of towards the end there, we covered just the latter days, because Daniel says that the dream has been given so that the king may know what will take place in the latter days. And we, you know, looked at, there's a number of ways you could do that, but just showed us that typically, for the most part, with some exceptions referring to the end of the Jewish age, the latter days or the end of the age is a reference to the church age. You know, I actually I'm going to peek here real quick in Matthew 28. Don't necessarily have to turn there. I was thinking about this earlier. So in Matthew 28, when Jesus says, "Go, therefore, make disciples of all the nations, immersing them in the name of the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit, teaching them to observe all that I commanded you, and lo, I am with you always, even to the end of the age." So, it's interesting because then the apostles lived for a few years after that, but was that the end of the age? No, and so that's how you know, like, you know, Jesus is telling the apostles this, but did that directive stop with the apostles? It continues on through the end of the age. So, just another quick example there of how end times, last ages, things like that are referred to. So there's our review. Let's jump on in. Daniel chapter 2, verse 31. He says, "You, O king, were looking, and behold, there was a single great statue, that statue which was large and of extraordinary splendor, was standing in front of you, and its appearance was awesome. The head of that statue was made of fine gold, its breast and its arms of silver, its belly and its thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, its feet partly of iron and partly of clay. You continued looking until a stone was cut out without hands, and it struck the statue on its feet of iron and clay and crushed them. Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, and the gold were crushed all at the same time and became like chaff from the summer threshing floors, and the wind carried them away so that not a trace of them was found. But the stone that struck the statue became a great mountain and filled the whole earth." We'll stop there because we have lots to cover. I always hesitate to do this, but I printed off a picture. And so I'm going to hand it around. I hesitate because then I lose all of your attention. So here's one for the front. And then we'll go about halfway back on both sides. I really benefit from visuals. This was something that Luke showed me a long, long time ago. Again, the section we read hasn't given us names of empires. We'll cover that later. But just kind of help you get an idea. I thought this picture always did a pretty good job of showing the different types of metals that comprise the statue. So feel free to look at that and ignore me as long as it's only for 5 or 10 seconds. All right. So, All right. What I want to do, because then the interpretation is coming next, I'm going to hold off on the gold, silver, and bronze, and just work on covering some definitions here for a minute, and then we'll focus in on some of the materials being used here. But quickly through, so the head was made of gold, and then the chest of arms of silver, the belly and the thigh of bronze, and the legs were made of iron, and the feet were a mix of iron and clay. And that was the dream. Okay? Cover a couple things here. We've got, basically, a statue and a rock. What's going on here? He says in verse 35, we've got the statue, iron, clay, bronze, silver, gold, were crushed by this stone and became like chaff from the summer threshing floor. So I just wanted to cover this really quick. Maybe some of us aren't familiar with this. What is chaff? You know, we live in farm country, but I've noticed a lot of people don't really know maybe what chaff is. Mark, you can yell it out. Okay, right. It's what's covering and protecting the grain head, right? So if you were to see a combine today in the way, you know, because we don't put the sickle to the crop anymore, right? So the we don't have a ton of combines in this area. We have swathers because we've got alfalfa growing everywhere. But, you know, if we had a lot of wheat and soybeans and corn and stuff like that, we have corn. So you've got the corn head coming through, right? And so it's pulling, it's cutting all the stalks, and it's running all of the corn heads into, and then the thresher's doing its thing in there, right? And what's it doing with the chaff? It's kicking it out the back. And so these machines have gotten really good because the machines also do a really good job of already starting to break down the chaff and then just and then spreading it out. So it's not, you know, it's kind of like when I used to mow the lawn with a lawnmower and close the side compartment and it would just leave a big old clump of streaks of, you know, grass behind. You don't want that. So these combines do a really good job of breaking up the chaff and then blowing it out the back, and it kind of spreads over the field pretty good. Decomposes a lot quicker, and that's good for the soil. So we've got chaff. You usually have to let your wheat and your soybeans and your corn kind of dry out before you harvest them, right? So when the water content of corn, let's say, is getting down into that 15% area, the plant that was covering the grain head has all dried out. Okay? To even where I know a lot of these guys in the Iowa area, sometimes they let their soybeans get too dry, because you need soybeans to be considerably drier than you do corn when you harvest them. And what happens is the soybeans get so dry that if a wind gust comes up, the chaff breaks, and then the soybeans just fall out of the pods. Okay, so that's how dry the chaff gets, all right? Now, what's the connection between chaff and the summer threshing floor? What's going on there? Separating, right? You ever heard of a winnowing fork? Okay, so, right, he grabs the wheat, takes the winnowing fork, okay, cuts it, puts it in a pile, and he's got his, well, I think we probably call them pitchforks today, okay, and they let it dry out. So then they wait for a nice breezy summer day, and they got the pile of their wheat there, okay, probably not doing soybeans like we do now, you know, whole another conversation. So they've got their winnowing fork, and they put it into the pile of wheat, and they kind of just toss it up in the air. And the chaff, which is covering the grain head, crumbles and just kind of, you know, kind of slightly blows away with the breeze, and then the heavier grain head just falls straight down. So if you've learned anything this morning, we're thankful for the combine. It really is amazing at how efficient them things are now these days, at the rate that they're able to pull in the amount. I mean, some of them got 24 row heads on them, and they don't leave a kernel behind. You know, it's incredible. But it's the process of separating the plant covering, the chaff, from around the seed head, so then all you're left with is the seed heads. Then that's when you go put them in the grinding mill, right? A lot of times those are made out of limestone. And so you would put what was left after the chaff blew away with the summer winds, and you would take, and this is a little bit extra, but this will make sense when we get to Matthew. So you take what's left, which is the grain head, which can be turned into bread, right? But you've got to grind it down first. So you'd put it on these big pillars of kind of sometimes circular limestone, and you would crush them between rocks. And one of the ways they were able to do that a little more efficiently is they would hook an ox up to a big, through a yoke and through a big wood thing to a limestone rock. And then the ox would just walk. But he would walk in circles, right? And they'd throw the grain up there. And as he was walking, he would turn the stone, and the stone would grind the grain, right? So that's why Paul says in 1 Corinthians, you don't muzzle an ox when he's treading the grain, okay? Because you've got this ox who's doing all the work, but they would muzzle the ox. Now, why would they muzzle the ox? Because they thought the ox was going to bite them? Yeah, he would reach down and he would eat the grain, which is very counterproductive because you got to fuel the machine that's producing the work, right? And so, you know, Paul gives an illustration for that, you know, kind of along the effects of those who live by the gospel, can get their living from the gospel. You would never want to muzzle, okay, in that way. So if you turn on over to Matthew chapter 3, You've got John baptizing. And the Pharisees and Sadducees coming out for baptism. And so he gets on them a little bit. And in verse 11, he says, "As for me, I baptize you with water for repentance, but he who is coming after me is mightier than I, and I am not fit to remove his sandals. He will baptize you with the Holy Spirit and fire. His winnowing fork is in his hand, and he will thoroughly clear his threshing floor, and he will gather his wheat into the barn, and he will burn up the chaff with unquenchable fire." You got the picture now? Jesus has his winnowing fork. The pile of wheat is the world. He takes it and he throws it up in the air and the good grains fall down. Okay, those are the Christians. And then the chaff gets separated by the wind. It's not like it's blowing miles and miles away, although depending on the wind, it could probably go pretty far. But you end up with a pretty decent sized pile of chaff kind of over here. And he takes the rake, puts it all up, puts it in a bag, and he throws it in the fire. Okay. So that's a picture of judgment. So I wanted to show us that because we don't want to be chaff, right? Jesus is coming. He's separating the righteous from among the wicked. Typically speaking, chaff is in judgment is a reference to those who don't make it. If you go to Psalm chapter 1, Psalm chapter 1, verse 4, okay, "The wicked are not so. They are like chaff, which the wind drives away." So if you didn't know this today, you know, that's great, because this is everywhere. Every time it talks about the wind driving, it's talking about that separation process. So the wicked, they're like chaff, which the wind drives away. "Therefore, the wicked will not stand in judgment, nor sinners in the assembly of the righteous. For the Lord knows the way of righteous, but the way of wicked will perish." You can turn back to Daniel. So that just helps us understand, you know, the purpose of the dream here. Because in the dream, you've got a stone and a statue. Which one turns into chaff and blows away? Statue. Okay. So, you know, that'll be important later, because I'll kind of get into the kingdoms of men versus the kingdoms of God before the morning's up. One of the other things in the end of verse 35 we notice about the dream is that in the end here, the stone that strikes the statue becomes a great mountain and fills the whole earth. Okay, that reminds me of Isaiah chapter 2. We'll turn there. Hold your spot in Daniel, because we're coming right back. Isaiah chapter 2, verse 2. It says, "Now it will come about in the last days." Pretty cool, right? So we used this verse last week to show what the last days are. "It will come about in the last days that the mountain of the house of the Lord will be established as the chief of mountains. It will be raised above the hills, and all the nations will stream to it." Very cool, right? Clearly a prophecy of the church, because the nations never streamed to God in the Old Testament. And even under the idea of premillennialism, the Gentiles have to be raptured away so that the Jews can be given a second chance to stream to God. So even in the teaching of premillennialism, the Gentiles never streamed to the mountain of God. If you look at it from a physical perspective, from the Old Testament. So this can only be fulfilled through the church. But he talks about, even Isaiah talks about, this mountain will be established. Do you think there's any accident that in the dream, the stone that hits the statue grows into a mountain? Okay, God's very consistent with his terminology and the way that he reveals this stuff through prophetic dreams. And we'll notice a lot of that today. Okay, so let's talk here a little bit about the metals for a second. What do you notice about the metals? I mean, they're just I mean, we use gold, silver, bronze, and iron today, right? Is there anything about the order they appear that maybe you've noticed before? Yes. Is that on purpose? Oh, yeah. Okay. I can't remember the quote, so I have to hold on to it. But Babylon, I mean, I get a little ahead of myself, but very successful nation, very rich in materials, very rich in resources. lots and lots of gold. But it's not even limited to that, so that's where I'll stop. But you got to notice that, do see that these metals are descending in order of value. So much so that by the time you get to the bottom, what's happening? It's not even metal anymore. So not only are we going from gold to silver, from silver to bronze, and from bronze to iron, but we end up going from gold to clay. Okay. Rain, you got a comment here?
Yeah, preciousness also exudes rarity. And then when you get down towards the feet, then it's pretty common, mm-hmm. real common. So wide is the path that leads to destruction, mm-hmm. and narrow is the path that leads to salvation, and few are those who find it. So there's kind of that order to it, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's going to be a little more we'll be able to pull out here, too, once we get to the interpretation of the dream. Thanks for the comment. I never know. I should go around you. You know that? Okay. Psalm chapter 2. Just kind of want to, I thought some of this was interesting to add with clay. Psalm chapter 2, Messianic. Yes? Yeah. Got a Messianic psalm here. Well, what does that mean? That means it's a psalm of Jesus. Okay. Well, how did I get there? Well, messianic means of the Messiah, right? Who was the Messiah? Jesus. This is a psalm of Jesus, 1,000 years before he's ever born. Let's pick up in verse 7. I will surely tell, and you always know that these are psalms of Jesus, because the New Testament tells you that. I didn't make that up, just to be clear, okay? The New Testament tells us this is about Jesus. You know, we're not just getting up here reading the Old Testament and being like, oh yeah, that sounds familiar, and then just, okay. He says, I will surely tell a decree to the Lord. He said to me, you are my son. Today I have begotten you. As of me, I will surely give the nations as your inheritance. That is so cool. Are you the nations? You are Jesus' inheritance. You're the thing that he got because he died. I mean, that's... Whew. The very ends of the earth as your possession. You shall break them with a rod of iron and shatter them like earthenware. And guess what that word should be for earthenware? Clay. Okay. Revelation chapter 2. How about more about Jesus? Revelation chapter 2, verse 26 says, he who overcomes and he who keeps my deeds until the end, to him I will give authority over the nations, and he shall rule them with a rod of iron, as the vessels of potter are broken to pieces, as I also have received authority from my Father. So, pottery, what I wanted to show us just in a couple quick verses here, is pottery or clay is broken easily. Okay? So here we see a couple examples of it being foretold that Jesus would shatter the pottery with his rod of iron. Okay? And Jesus does that. Okay? Or is going to do that. All right? So not only do we have a statue that's descending in order of value, to where now it's not even a metal. Okay, now we've got clay mixed in there. But the other thing that's happening is now it can be broken. Right? Because, and I'll come right there. Because the other thing you're going to see, which is very convicting for me, is doesn't the iron shatter the metals before it? It says it does. Okay? So even as the metals go down, iron's a pretty strong metal, and we're going to talk about that in a little bit. So not only is it descending in value, and I'll tell you why here in a minute, okay, but the infusion of clay is not only a communication of deteriorating, but also in a position that if God can strike it with his rod of iron, it's going to shatter. Okay, because it's prophesied that Jesus will shatter the clay with the rod of iron.
You basically touched on it, but it's increasing, decreasing value and increasing strength. And I've always found it interesting that the very pinnacle of the strength is in the iron, and that is what God uses to destroy the rest. And so it's interesting in my mind because as the world looks at it, they increase in strength, but the Lord's going to use that very perspective to crush everything else.
Yes. Yeah. And so it's we who see this are like, how can you not believe in God? Look at this. This detail the mind of man cannot do. Look, the mind of men can write some pretty interesting, you know, stories. Pretty gripping, interesting stories, and a lot of us have read them. But to have this stuff woven in, foreshadowing and fulfilling types, and done ahead of time, and then done by visions, and then fulfilled 1,000 years later in Jesus, and in judgment. Like, look at all of this, right? It is descending order of value, but it's getting stronger because it has iron. But Jesus says, I will use iron to break clay, and then all of a sudden the clay shows up with the iron. It is incredible. Okay. Couple more definitions here. Make sure we're covering this stuff. What does the stone represent? I'm getting a little ahead of myself here because in the dream it doesn't say, but I'm doing it on purpose for a reason because we'll come back to this. Okay. What does the stone represent? The church. The follow-up question then is, why does God use a stone? I couldn't hear you. Living stone? Yeah, sure. Show us some verses here. I mean, this is how I think, and this is not always like the right way. But could anything hit in the statue? Okay. But God does stuff for a reason. So I like to think about those things. Okay? I don't know if you could call a meteorite a stone, but I mean a meteorite could have hit this thing. Okay? I mean, it could have just gotten blown over. I don't know. But the point is that he chose a stone. Here's why. Psalm 118. What's that?
I just said the stone represents Jesus and the church.
Did we miss something?
Huh?
Did we miss something?
No.
Oh, okay.
I didn't hear you say Jesus and the church. Like the church.
Yeah, and I'm ahead of myself. I'm coming back to why, yeah. So, let you jump in there. I thought maybe you were referring. Have you guys been hearing all this stuff that's gaining popularity out there right now about how there's seeds of life all over the creation and how they travel on meteorites? I thought maybe I opened. If you don't know, ask me afterwards. Can't do that now. You know, 15 minutes left. But I thought maybe I opened that can of worms in your mind, saying meteorite. Okay. I am a little ahead of myself right now. We want to get to Jesus and the church being the stone. I'm just showing us, like, when you go through this, like, because we know Daniel too, and it's easy to read over this. Why is it a stone? Okay. Because that's consistent with everything God has used throughout the whole Bible. And I just wanted to show us some examples. So Psalm 118, okay, Messianic Psalm? Yes, another psalm about Jesus. Verse 22, the stone which the builders rejected becomes the chief cornerstone. Okay, and then the New Testament tells us that this is fulfilled in Jesus. Okay, so this is consistent. The stone that's hitting it isn't just because God thought this would be a cool thing that grows into a mountain, right? The stone that hits it, it's Jesus, and then grows into an entire mountain, which is the church. But he prophesied that it would be a stone. But let's follow this out here for a second, all right? Isaiah 28. Look, and I do kind of want to, you know, I want to make sure we covered our definitions. There's so many verses, and if some of you guys are sitting there thinking, oh man, what about, look, I had to just pick a couple, right? And Isaiah filled with references to the stone. I did land in Isaiah 28, though, because it's messianic. You guys are listening. I love this. Isaiah 28, messianic section here, verse 16. Therefore, thus says the Lord God, behold, I am laying in Zion a stone. Written before Daniel, right? Prophesied before Daniel. Was Psalm prophesied before Daniel? Do we see why God calls it a stone and not a brick? A stone, a tested stone, a costly cornerstone for the foundation firmly placed. He who believes in it will not be disturbed. I'll stop there. But the New Testament quotes these verses saying that Jesus is the fulfillment of this stone. Now, you guys remember the three-part series that I just finished up, right? And that whole series began with the idea of why is Paul focused so much on the cross with the Corinthian? And the answer was what? Because the cross, which is the death of the Jewish God, right, was a stumbling stone to the Jews. So Romans 9 comes straight out. And Romans 9 says, hey, how is it that the Gentiles are accepting this message so much and that it was such a hard thing for the Jews that they killed Jesus? And Paul says to the Romans, largely the Jews missed it because they were trying to receive it through it on the basis of works, on the basis of law. And then it quotes this verse and says they stumbled over the stumbling stone. Okay, they stumbled over Jesus Christ. So the New Testament tells us that this is fulfilled in Jesus. And then if you go back to 1 Corinthians chapter 1 and 2, that's where the messages came from the last few weeks. And Paul says to the Corinthian, he says, the Jew in large missed the message of Jesus because they stumbled over the stumbling block. And the stumbling block for them was that their God came and then died. And that was a stumbling stone for them. So this not only is very consistent in Old Testament prophetic language, but it actually has a very important role to play in fulfilled messianic prophecy. So wanted to bring that out. That's why it's a stone and not a brick or a meteorite. Okay, Daniel chapter 2, let's get back here. Keep using your guys as help here. Why is, in verse 34, why is the stone cut out of the mountain without hands? Without human agency. It's actually the literal. It's like the perfect literal rendering of how that, I just dug into that a couple days ago. Yeah, the literal comes through in actually a couple different places in the Old Testament. Without human agency is what that says. So it's cut out, the stone is cut out of the mountain without hands, meaning that, well, if man didn't do it, then that means God did it. And, you know, if that wasn't enough, verse 44, okay, says, in the days of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom, and then he says, it will crush and bring an end to the other kingdoms. So, verse 44 confirms for us that the stone was cut out without hands is directly referring to God's the one who cut it out and God's the one who hurled it at the statue. Okay, we understand that. 2 Corinthians chapter 5 is a really great example of this. 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 1. It says, "For we know that if the earthly tent, which is our house, is torn down, we have a building from God, a house not made with hands, eternal in the heavens." So just another great place, another great picture of how this one is going to break down and go back to the dirt from where it came, because we are Adam. The new one, made without hands, so it is eternal. Which is cool, because then the stone, which was cut out without hands, is it eternal in the vision? It is. Because not only does it hit and shatter the statue and grow into a mountain that fills the whole earth, but it itself endures forever. Brett.
What I think's cool about this, too, is it's referred to as the rock of offense or the stone of offense. And this is to those nations. Mm-hmm. And he just pitches it right at them. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So it's very offensive to the nations.
Yeah. Well, let's actually, let's maybe follow that thought here. I got a few minutes, so I just want to make sure I'm going to wrap up here in a good spot. I'm going to wait. Great comment, right? It's like, I don't want to get ahead of myself, but I mean, Jesus says he is the rock, right, in the Gospels? And he says, fall on the rock, which is me, Jesus says, you know, and you will be broken. And if you don't, the rock gonna fall on you, and you're gonna be shattered, which then you would mean you became chaff, right? So, excellent comment. We'll probably go there and hit that verse next week. Okay, one more thought here, and then, you know, open up to any other thoughts, comments, questions about the dream itself, and then we'll move to its interpretation. Just also reminds me of how important Colossians chapter 2 is. You know, I've had a chance to sit in on a couple random Bible studies recently, and man, it is a very, very popular teaching out there to refute baptism's to refute baptism being faith, and to put it in the category of works. And look, I understand how someone could get there, you know, in their mind. You know, of all the excuses for why baptism isn't in connection to salvation, a lot of them make no sense to me at all. The one that makes somewhat sense to me is, you know, I mean, you look at the way that the Catholic Church sprung up and the way that it's steeped in its rituals and its works, and you're trying to reform away from that. I see why Luther did it. You know, he just went too far and then changed the Bible and said faith alone. I mean, I sat in a Bible study a week ago. Wasn't my Bible study. I'm just sitting in. I was just quiet. You know, tried to keep to myself. Where they were studying in Romans chapter 6. And I thought, thanks, Lord. I mean, I've been trying to go to this Bible study for a year, you guys. And then the day I show up, they're in Romans 6. Thank you, Lord. So I sit down waiting for my turn, and we're 2 minutes into the Bible study, and the guy leading the Bible study has already said salvation through faith alone twice. Does the Bible ever say that? Faith alone? Okay, but his does in Romans 3, because that's what Martin Luther did. Okay, some other comments were made. Quoting Ephesians 2, we're dead in our sins, in our trespasses and sins. And he said, and he had a picture of the body, soul, and spirit diagram. And he said, and I believe that that deadness extends all the way through us so much that we can't even repent of ourselves. So he's what? Calvinist. Can you have a baptism conversation with a Calvinist? No, you can't. So I was like, Romans 6, let's go! Bummer, man. Okay. But this idea that there's nothing that you can do, this works idea, that's consistent with the scriptures. The scriptures say it, but the Bible calls baptism faith, not works. And Colossians is important for that because it says, in him you were circumcised with a circumcision made without hands. You see how important that is? Okay, so we've got this stone that's cut out without hands. And we've got this body of glory that's waiting for us. And it was made without human agency. And then Colossians tells us that in our baptisms, we were circumcised in a circumcision not done with hands, which tells you who's doing it, which means who's doing the work? God. And then if that wasn't enough for you, the next line in the verse says, in the working of God. So it tells you who's doing the work, all right? So just a really important verse for trying to show. You go to Galatians 3, and it tells you you are Christians because of your faith for when you were immersed. And it just connects the two right there together. Okay, Daniel chapter 2. I want to read this, and then we'll be in a great place to wrap up. This was the dream, verse 36. Now we will tell its interpretation before the king. You, O king, are the king of kings to whom the God of heaven has given the kingdom, the power, the strength, and the glory. That is very important. This is why he is the gold. Who gave Nebuchadnezzar his kingdom? God. You go, and we'll do it next week. You go read in Jeremiah. God says, I'm bringing this king. I'm establishing this king. I'm giving him power. Now, it's temporal, right? To serve God's purpose. But look, this is the dream. And its interpretation begins with the fact that Nebuchadnezzar was given his power by God. Okay? Because it's interesting. How did the Persians get their power? Well, kings and kingdoms never rise and fall apart from God, right? But the Persian kings, they ascended to the throne based on patronage. They ascended to the throne based on lineage. Okay? How did the Greeks ascend to the throne? Well, they didn't need a declination from God. They didn't need to have royal ancestry. The Greeks ascended to the throne because of position and power and influence. All you got to be is the greatest. All you got to be is the greatest commander in the whole kingdom, and you can be king. And then now you have Alexander the Great, right? Then you get down to Rome. Did Rome need appointment by the gods? Did Rome need to have royal bloodline? Did you have to be a mighty warrior and commander to be Caesar in Rome? No, you just had to have the popular vote of the people. And you got balance being shifted between the people and the Senate and the king. Okay, so what you're seeing is in the descending order of value, you're seeing where God's behind putting the power there, and then it just mankind takes it for themselves over and over and over and over again. And then it just ascends into chaos. Okay? It's always got to be God. You know, it's interesting because even Cyrus, who was a Persian king, said he knew that he was appointed there by God. He knew that. When you start separating God from the position of king, you deteriorate very quickly. Okay? So you are the verse 37, power, strength, and the glory where the sons of men dwell, the beasts of the field, birds of the sky has given them to your hands. You have caused you to rule over them. You are the head of gold. After you, there will rise another kingdom inferior to you and another third kingdom of bronze, which will rule over the earth. There will be a fourth kingdom as strong as iron. Inasmuch as iron crushes and shatters all things, so iron that breaks in pieces, it will crush and break all these in pieces. In that you saw the feet and toes partly of potter's clay and partly of iron, it will be a divided kingdom, but it will have in it the toughness of iron, inasmuch as you saw the iron mixed with the common clay. As the toes of the feet were partly of iron, partly of pottery, so the kingdom will be strong and part of it will be brittle. In that you saw the iron mixed with the common clay, they will combine with one another in the seed of men, but would not adhere to one another, even as iron does not combine with pottery. And in the days of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which will never be destroyed, and that kingdom will not be left for another people, and it will crush and put an end to all these kingdoms, but itself will endure forever. And we'll cover the rest of that next week. Thanks, guys.